Hi, I'm Sherry Gallier. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Sherry.
And you are kidding, no reason.
Picked you up in one.
Yeah, and I probably don't need that because I am loud. I'm the only child I know that is like super loud. I don't know who I was trying to make myself heard for growing up, but I guess because I was so self-important, everybody had to hear what I had to say. I'll get the formalities. My sobriety date is November 20th, 2007. I currently don't have a home group. I left my home group of many, many years, the Keystone Group, at the first of the year, and a series of medical issues and some other things have kind of forayed my home group searching a little bit. So I am a girl in search of a home group, and after hopefully just one more surgery, I can settle down in somewhere, but it's given me a chance to go to meetings I wouldn't ordinarily go to find different people. And not that AA isn't the same everywhere you go, but it's not the same everywhere you go. And where I was for so long and where I got sober, of course they do it exactly right. And some of the meetings I've gone to in the last 6 months, they're not doing it the way I think they should be doing it, but it's been a great experience in having an open mind, being patient, and just really learning a different way to hear the message. And it's been and it's been eye-opening for me too. I also have a sponsor who I saw Friday night. She comes over, I go over her house, and we read or we talk, and we've had a close relationship. She's only the second sponsor I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous, and both of them have helped me tremendously. Usually, when I give my talk, I talk a lot about my first sponsor because my first sponsor really kind of grounded me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Also, I get to sponsor other women, two of which came up with me today. Thank you very, very much for being my road dogs. And thank you, Billy, for asking me. It's always a privilege to be able to, be of service in AA. I used to think speaking would be what I like the most because of my ego, and it's actually what I don't like the most, probably because of my ego. But yeah, it is. It's so funny. Somebody told me before I left, they're like, once you get in the car with the girls and get up there, you know how much you love going. You love the people. You love Alcoholics Anonymous. You're right. You're right. I still have that little voice in my head that's like, oh, do you want to do this? Why did you say yeah? Blah, 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 blah. But it all works out okay. And also happy Father's Day. I don't, I haven't spoken in a little while, so I'm not sure what God has in store for you or for me, but I know my dad played a huge part in my life and my sobriety, so I don't know if that will play out in what I share with you today. I kind of hope so, because I was a daddy's girl. I love my daddy. I was born, raised in Richmond, Virginia. I have lived elsewhere in the country, but I always came home. And I grew up in a really, kind of, I don't like to use the word normal, but a good family. There was really, I mean, I said I was an only child. One of the reasons was I was adopted. I was adopted as a very small child, so I don't remember anything about, my biological parents. But I say that not because being adopted had makes me an alcoholic or anything, but I say that because I wasn't exposed to any kind of alcoholism or drinking or anything. My dad was actually a Baptist minister, and we were the Baptist type that there was no booze, no dancing, no card playing, no, we couldn't, my mom didn't cook on Sundays, none of that. Very strict. And my mom was more of the disciplinarian of the family. Even though my dad was the preacher, he was much more open-minded and understanding about things. So I kind of gravitated toward that because even as a child, I was real hard-headed. I was very willful, very rebellious, And the signs of, that kind of alcoholic thinking were there super, super early. I mean, I can remember the first lie I ever told. I am a, I lying has served me all the way up till, I got sober. I mean, and I remember I wanted Daddy again. He used to like to play when my mom wasn't home, solitaire, right? And he had it, and I had this little miniature deck of cards, right? And I wanted him to play solitaire with my cards. And he would say, "No, Sherry, they're too small for my big hands." So what I did was I hid his regular deck of playing cards, and he couldn't find them. And I'll never forget. I hit him, and he said, "Sherry, you see my cards?" I said, "No, but you can use mine." So he didn't question it. He probably knew, but that was the first lie I ever told, and I didn't get caught, and I got my way. So it served me, all the way through. If I wanted to alter what you thought about me, or I wanted you to, not see what I was really doing, I would lie. And then in my alcoholism, of course, by the time I got to that far, I was a expert. So I always had that kind of willful, rebellious, streak in me. And I was fascinated with booze early, even though it wasn't in my family, even though I didn't see it. I saw it on TV. I saw it in, my mom watched General Hospital, and I remember watching those people drink, and it looked so attractive to me. They had those beautiful crystal cut glasses, and they would pull that, whatever, what do they call it? A decanter, with the beautiful top off of it, and pour their three fingers of scotch over the one large ice cube, and just relax, the quartermains at the end of the day on their plush sofa. And I was like, "Oh, that looks cool." Scotch even sounded good. My favorite television show growing up was MASH. And they, that show really showed me that alcohol was just the cure-all for everything. Hawkeye, end of the day, hard surgery, been at war, what are they gonna do? Head straight for the stew. Head straight for the O Club, whatever it was. Alcohol would just kind of take the edge off, and I think that just kind of like melted into my brain. So when I got a little older, 7th, 8th grade, where kids were experimenting with alcohol, I was all about it. I wanted to know what's going on, and it's funny, my dad, he disclosed this to me later, after it had become apparent that I had a problem with alcohol. He said to me, he said, "I used to have a problem with alcohol." He goes, "I'm what you call a teetotaler." That's an old-fashioned word for he just stopped. He's like the Big Book describes, he was a certain type of heavy drinker that, given enough reason, sufficient reason, he could stop or moderate. Well, he just stopped altogether. He wanted to go places in life. And he told me at the time, he said, I always told myself, if this ever affected my job or this ever affected what I wanted to do in my career, I would stop drinking." And it started to affect how, he was late for work. He had missed some work. He needed to go back to school. He didn't know how he could do that and drink. So he just stopped drinking. And that never made any sense to me. But I say that to say, at a young age, 12, 11, 12, 13, we would get alcohol every now and again as gifts. He was also a school teacher. He wasn't a full-time minister. It was a teeny tiny church he preached at as I was growing up in Quentin, Virginia. So sometimes teachers, that didn't know him well, would gift him alcohol. And one time someone had gifted my parents a bottle of wine. And they had kept it, and I don't know how long it had been in the pantry. I don't know, but I wanted to try it. I wanted to get that feeling like Hawkeye and the Quartermaine. I want. Of course, there's no corkscrew in my house, so I get the bottle out. My parents were not there, and I ended up, trying to figure out how do you get a cork out. I ended up like, mashing the cork down into the bottle and pouring like a juice glass full of wine, and just hit it back, vinegar. straight vinegar and cork was what I drank, you know. And then one time we broke into a friend's liquor cabinet, and the only thing we could find, we thought vermouth sounded good for whatever reason, so we tried to drink vermouth. So I didn't get my first real drunk, which I don't remember the drinking part, like the effects. I hear people talk about, you know, they remember that first good drunk that they have. I don't remember that part, but I was on a vacation with my parents. At this time, my mom had actually like stopped working and started her own business as a tour guide. She had her own tour company. So she would do like pre-packaged bus tours for people that were retired. So she would get everything together and, you know, present this package and we're going to go here and everything's paid for and da 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 da. So this time they took me to Alaska. It was a cruise to Alaska. And anybody that's ever been on a cruise ship, you know, the booze runs like fountain. And, you know, another thing I had, you know, kind of been going through since I can remember was I never really felt like I fit in. I was a good liar, so I was a good faker, and I was a good actress, so I could manage to get through school. But, you know, I never, ever really felt like I was in stride with everybody else. I always felt like I was a step behind, or those people don't know what's going on. You know, it was never, I never felt like I was in a level playing field. And I never, I always just wanted to fit in. I just always wanted to be a part of. So in this cruise to Alaska, like I said, my mom catered to people that were retirement age. So on these trips, I would often be the youngest person, and my mother would be like the second youngest person. So I found my peers. I found people that were, I was like 15. So I found people that were between like 15 and 19, let's say, or 18. And we all kind of banded together. And back then, this was the 80s. You didn't need any money to get drunk on a cruise ship. You could just charge everything to your room. So I would saddle myself up to the bar, and they didn't card you either. If you knew what you wanted to order, you could get it. So, and for the first time, I felt like I had found my people, you know, I had found my tribe. And so I stayed pretty much lit the whole time on that cruise to Alaska. And so when I came home and went back into school, I had lost, I never really had much interest in school. But whatever little teeny weensy bit of interest I had was gone. And I found my people in school, you know, and that was my sophomore year. So that was the beginning of, I mean, alcohol was fun. I mean, I sometimes I've heard, you know, my former home group was a speaker meeting as well. So sometimes I would hear stories where people would start drinking and everything was immediately bad, but that's not the case for me. You know, I didn't get caught doing anything when I was in high school. We were drinking, you know, the Bartles and James. We were drinking the Boone's Farm. We were slamming down the Black Label, you know, and it was good times. You snuck it into the movies. You kept a cooler in your trunk. You know, you would go to the football games. You would do that kind of stuff. and there were no consequences. Not that I could really see. The only consequences I had, and I think this was all part of that rebellious, shifty, lying, dishonest, deceitful life that I had kind of developed over my teenage, you know, preteen and teenage years, was, you know, I didn't have any ambition. I had no real drive or desire to do anything or to become anything. I did the least amount of work to get by when it came to something worthwhile, like school or getting into college. Now, I would move heaven and earth to be able to get what I wanted, which was trying to secure the, you know, the vodka and the orange juice for the Friday night party, or to catch that person's eye if we were going out to this club or whatever. I would move heaven and earth to do that because it satisfied my own needs. But anything that was for the betterment of anybody around me, or do anything that was helpful or convenient or of service to anybody in my family, or anywhere, not even on my radar. I didn't care. And so I never had any like career aspirations. I never had any college aspirations. I never had any of that. I did the least amount of work to get by. I was lazy, pure and simple. And that plays out all into my recovery as well. And and the more I kind of drank and sort of drifted away from any morals or values I ever had, the more I alienated my family. And I came home and I started getting in trouble. Don't get me wrong, there were consequences, but I mean, not like juvie consequences. I would get grounded, or I get in trouble, or I get the lecture from my mother, or whatever. I remember coming home from school one day, and both of my parents' cars were outside the house, and I'm like, oh God, what did I do now? What I get caught for now, and I'm running through the dialogue in my head. I get upstairs, and I remember my dad called me upstairs and said, come upstairs. We're in the bedroom. We need to talk to you. And I said, well, that's weird. Why are you in the bedroom? Why are you talking to me upstairs in the bedroom? So I go up there. My mom, I'll never forget, my mom was laying in the bed, and my dad was like sitting on the bed beside her. And they said, come in here, sit down. We need to talk to you. And I said, what's going on? And they said, we need to tell you. Your mom is sick. She has cancer, and she's going to be undergoing some pretty serious treatments. And things are going to change. She's going to be sick, and we wanted you to know that, but we also want you to know that we're not telling anybody. Your mother doesn't want to let anybody know that she's sick, because I don't know if they said she doesn't want to explain herself, but the gist of it was she didn't want to have to explain herself. But the big thing was she didn't want anybody to lose confidence in her company. She didn't want, because she was, head of the company. So we were to keep this a family secret. And I was like, okay. Of course, I go to school and I tell everybody, because I want people to feel sorry for me. Well, Sherry, why didn't you do your homework? Well, my mom is sick, so I had to, Sherry, why did you skip 3 days of school? Well, my mom is sick. I mean, I used her illness to get away with stuff. And it was kind of, it was really sad, because it was obvious she was going through chemotherapy, but she would lie about it, And so I'm getting these, and this is all in hindsight. None of this occurred to me at the time, but I got these mixed messages, when it came time for me to, obviously I had a problem. You need to seek help, or you need to talk to somebody about it, or you need to do this, or you shouldn't be such a liar. I could remember kind of thinking, well, you didn't do any of that. Why should I? Why should I have to? But the sicker my mom got, and I was in high school, so the sicker my mom got, really the sicker I got, because it just kind of, I just really just busted loose. I don't even know how I graduated from high school. Pity. My dad, like I said, was a school teacher. He didn't teach at my high school, but he taught in the same school district. So I don't know if he greased the skids. I don't know. For me, same reason. I applied to one college, and my grade, I mean, I could find my grade point average probably. I'm moving right now, so I'm like finding all this crap that I've never thrown away. Was not great, but I got into VCU. And back then, VCU was the school that you went to when you couldn't get into any other school, which it is not the case now. And so I got into VCU, and I didn't do anything with it. I'd been given this golden opportunity. I just discovered like garage bands and punk rock and things other than alcohol, and a whole new group of friends, some of which may or may not have been homeless. And I discovered the whole city of Richmond was, my at my beck and call. All the bars that would let you in and drink underage, so I'm still having fun with alcohol. And I didn't really pay attention to anything that was going on at home. I mean, how selfish is that? I'm an only child. My mom is sick. My dad's trying to still work two jobs and take care of her. She's still trying to struggle to go to work. I remember one morning I had a, they had sold me their car. My first car was a 76 Vega with the aluminum engine, and you could hear it coming. And I remember my mom, for some reason, was walking to work. Her office was not far from the home that I grew up in, and she was walking to work. And I caught up with her. And I'm like, "Get in the car, Mom. I'll give you a ride." And she, I remember her looking at me. She goes, "I'm not getting in the car with you, you know." And I can imagine how I smelled at like 19 years old, you know. And so I just and that's the lifestyle that I led. And if anybody's led that kind of lifestyle, you know, you draw a line in the sand and you step over it. You know, you're gonna do this, you might as well do that. So I ended up running a little afoul of the law, trying to, you know, fit in and have money and not an actual job. And I thought to myself, you know, what's the problem? You know what the problem was? It was Richmond. It was Richmond. So what do you do when the problem is the city that you live in? You move. So I figured, you know, I've been drinking a little too much. I've been doing a little other things, or well, way too much. I had friends that had moved out of state, and they were like, "Why don't you come down here and live with us? You know, we'll let you stay with us until you can get on your feet." I'm like, "Oh my God, that's a great idea." So you know where I moved to, like, help, like, curtail my alcoholism? New Orleans, Louisiana. That was brilliant, right? Yeah. So it did teach me all about the morning drink. And I'll tell you right now, that never seemed strange to me. It always seemed perfectly normal to take a drink first thing in the morning. Never did I think, "Oh, I've crossed some line." I'd be like, "Why didn't I think of this before? This is great." You know, I'm putting it in my coffee. I'm taking shots when I get to work. I mean, it was normal. When everybody around you is doing the same thing, I mean, you don't even think twice. But not everybody around me was probably an alcoholic. Not everybody around me, you know, goes out for their 1 hour lunch break, blacks out, and never comes back to work. You know, it's not supposed to happen. So I was in downtown New Orleans. I was working, and I was my day off, and I was working at a bar, of course. And there had been a stabbing in the bar, like right across the street. And I was in a little grocery store, neighborhood grocery store. And I remember my friend came in, and they're like, "Sherry, the cops are outside and they wanted to talk to you." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, I'll go out there. That's fine." I said, "They probably want to ask me about what happened across the street the other night." So I go out there, and there was like four Orleans Parish police cars and like all these. And they're like, "Are you Sherry Gallier?" And I'm like, "Yes." And they arrested me. I'm like, "What's going on?" They had picked me up on a fugitive warrant from Virginia. I'd been on probation, and they had come to the house. And my mom was like, "Well, she's living in New Orleans. Here's her address, you know. Why don't you go see if you can help her out?" And so they picked me up. And so, first time I ever went to jail, I went to, I mean, actual jails, like spent the night and couldn't get out, no bond, was Orleans Parish Prison in about probably about a 16 months before my mom passed away. And stayed down there. I got stuck down there for 88 days. They had 2 days to come and extradite me from Virginia before they were going to cut me loose. And guess who came and got me on day 88? Virginia. So they came and got me, came back up to Richmond. Got my sentence. I had actually been in the car with someone who was selling drugs, and I had been the person to do a hand-to-hand contact sale. So I got a distribution of heroin charge at 19 years old. Two of them, because it was 2 different days I did it. And of course it was. And I used my mom's illness once again to say, "Oh, I gotta be home. My mom is sick. I was just 19. It was a big mistake. It was all his fault. Blah, 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 blah." And they bought it and they put me on house arrest. It was like a get out of jail free card, you know? I was hauling up Southern Comfort through my window. I had friends bringing up 12 packs. You know, I was smoking the wacky tobacco in my room. You know, nothing mattered except for what I wanted or needed in that moment. And then, but you know, I was able to be home and I was able to be there, so to speak, in body, physically be there when my mom passed away. And, but emotionally, spiritually, mentally, not one bit. Wasn't there for my dad. I wasn't there for any part of the family. And after that, my mom died in 92. And after that, that was all she wrote. And if anybody knows, once you've actually gotten into the system with whatever kind of charge, they put you on this thing called probation. And your probation officer kind of frowns on it when you don't show up for meetings or you give a breathalyzer and blow, you know, like a 0.09 at 9 a.m. You know, they frown on that kind of thing. So the 90s and early 2000s were a merry-go-round for me for jails, rehab centers, outpatient, conversion therapy, more geographic. I went out to California, out to San Diego, tried to get over out there. I went to Tennessee, tried to get, you know, it was just all the things, all the time, always constantly me running, and me trying to figure it out. My head saying, this is what's going to work this time. Don't listen to them. Don't do that, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, because of this, you know, I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous fairly early. Actually, I've been introduced before, you know, I got into that whirlwind of treatment and jail and this. I had been introduced to it and wanted nothing to do with it. You know, I had been raised in this religious family. I had been raised in this church with people that I thought were hypocrites. You know, I came to AA. I was pretty young. So, of course, I immediately identified out. And plus, I didn't want to stop. I had no reason to stop. My life was in the toilet. I was hurting everybody around me, but I didn't want to stop. You know, so anybody in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous has said to me, sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher, wah, 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 wah. You know, and I was nasty and defiant and sat in the back, no smoking meetings, I would light up, you know, I was horrible. I was absolutely horrible. And so I remember I was in some sort of treatment thing. I remember somebody saying, a counselor, somebody saying, well, there are this, you know, very small percentage of people that get sober without the help of a 12-step program. And I latched onto that for like 15 years. I'm going to be that person. I don't need you people. I don't need you telling me what to do. I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to be that 0.0.0. whatever that just stops drinking, you know, miraculous. Well, if anybody knows, after that many years of not just the physical effects of drinking and the physical effects of, you know, trying to run your own life into the ground, and the mental agony of every single day, waking up and saying, how am I going to get it together today? What did I say last night? What lies do I need to come up with today? What story do I need to spin? You know, that is madness and it's exhausting. And I get tired. I got really, really tired. And there were a couple of times, you know, throughout that time period where I would have these little aha moments where I would say, do you think it's the booze? You know, do you think? No, it's not, you know, no, it couldn't possibly be. I could not. I was at the jumping off point for probably 10 years where I could not picture myself with alcohol and I could not picture myself without it, you know, but that desire to drink, that not being able to picture my life without alcohol was way stronger than trying to follow some direction from somebody else. It was way stronger. And so I continued in that cycle, and I can remember standing in a 7-Eleven, at freaking 5 minutes to six in the morning, waiting for them to open the beer cooler, and thinking and going to pull on the beer cooler, and it's still locked, and I get pissed off. I gotta stand in line with all these people in suits, and I remember looking at them, looking at people in suits with the little 7-Eleven coffee cups, and I'd be like, they don't know what life is. This is living, and I would just be. Just I was just nasty, and I was mad because I had to ask somebody to open the beer cooler. And I don't know what it was, but I came home after a relatively short jail stint for me. I'll tell you, I probably spent a grand total of. I think I counted it up one time. I think it's like 13 years and some change in the penal system. The longest period of time that I did incarcerated was 6 years in a row. And I did jail well. I got in there, I was safe, I knew everybody, I knew the routine, and I didn't have to make any decisions. All my major decisions were made for me. I screwed up when I got home and I had to make a decision. I didn't know I could ask for help. Of course, I knew it, but I didn't want to because I didn't want anybody to know I didn't already know the answer. Or I didn't want anybody to think I was stupid. Or I didn't want anybody to think that I couldn't do this. I didn't, it was ludicrous, but I'm sure I'm in a room full of people who can at least sort of relate to that kind of thinking. But I remember coming home and I was like, I am not going to drink. This time, I am not going to drink. My daddy was my biggest champion. So I came home and I got a job, worked about between 60 and 70 hours a week. I excelled. I could always get a job. Convicted felon, always get a job because I had the gift of gab. So I lasted about 4 months and I was crazy. When I wasn't working, I was washing the wallpaper and cleaning the floorboards and like picking lint off of the carpet. Everything had to be just so. And all my clothes were like totally folded and neat, the irons. I mean, I was crazy. And I'd go to work and I'd be happy and joyful. And somebody would say something. I'd say, what did you say to me? And this is stone cold sober. I have a friend of mine, David Francis, that calls it sobriety. I was crispy. And I was barely hanging on. I mean, I felt like every day I woke up, I was running with a gun to the back of my head, just going, going, going. I can't drink, I can't drink, I can't drink. And I can't sustain that. So what did I do? I had to get some freaking relief. And I didn't even pretend it was going to be different this time. Nope. I said, I just need to be able to breathe. So I drank, but I didn't want to drink. And it was the first time ever that I drank and I didn't want to. And it was the first time ever I went and asked for help. But this is what I asked for help. And this is the madness I was in. I went to my PO and I said, you gotta lock me up. And she said, what? You're doing great. What are you talking about? I'm like, no, I cannot stay sober. You need to lock me up. I don't do, I can't live out here. I'm not safe. I'm not safe for others, I'm not safe for myself. You gotta do it. And I'll never forget, she looked straight at me and she said, Sherry, I believe in you. Now, if you pee into this cup and it's not clean, I will have to lock you up, but I'm not going to keep you there. And I said, oh, give me the cup, give me the cup, because I was not clean. So I went, but she, good to her word, she had to make sure she got me into a women's sobriety house. And but she had to make sure that I was sober when I got there, so there wasn't, alcohol is a scary little detox. But I wasn't that far along yet. So after 5 days, they let me out and I went to the women's sobriety house. And I was the most, as much as I had hated Alcoholics Anonymous before, I was the most obnoxious person about being sober. I was like, hey, where y'all going? Y'all going to meet? Let's go to a meeting. Let's go. Blah, blah, blah. And I had, and that's where I met my first sponsor. I actually went back to a meeting at a place called Willow Oaks, which was my first and hopefully my last treatment center. It was an old 28-day program in a farmhouse. And they had an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous out there in Cartersville, Virginia. And my first sponsor was Big Book Thumper, for lack of a better word, and took the time to sit down and read with me. And I was ready. I mean, I was thirsty, but I wasn't thirsty for the booze and stuff. I was thirsty for something different. And I was still a little scatterbrained. So I would read, and we had a dictionary, and we would look up words and didn't know. And when they said pray, we prayed. When it said write, we wrote. All the things, you know. Did a lot of talking. I listened to a lot of speaker tapes. I got introduced to Joe and Charlie. I got introduced to Sandy Beach, you know. All the people. Patty O. And I just ate it up. I ate it up. And I was on fire, you know. I was going to a gazillion meetings a week. I was going to be president of my sober house, you know. My dad loved me again. And I will never forget. I remember I had a big book, and I was at home staying with my dad. And I said, Daddy, I said, you read the big book? I left you a big book to read. And he goes, no. And I said, why not? I said, it's changed my life. He goes, that's just a bunch of crap. And I loved my daddy. Loved him so much, and that hurt me so bad. And I said, what? He said, why can't you just quit drinking? And I was like, I don't know. I didn't have an answer. You know, I was probably about 4 or 5 months sober. I didn't have an answer, but it crushed me. And what I know today is I can't explain it to everybody. And not everybody needs a 12-step program. Not everybody needs Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it doesn't, you know, this is what works for me. You know, when I admit my life is unmanageable and I am powerless over alcohol, and I, you know, start to believe in a power that's greater than me, you know, and I start to take actions that look like turning my life over, and I start to take other actions like writing inventory and seeing what I'm really capable of, and then making a sincere effort to do something about it, those things make a difference in my life. But I don't have the power to convince anybody else. You know, that's none of my business. Now, if that had been said to me today, I would have taken it differently. Would it have hurt me still today? Of course. But I would have taken it differently. But I took that straight to heart. And the other thing that was going on was, you know, a lot of things start happening when you're sober, newly sober. And one of those things started happening to me with my hormones. And I thought the only thing that I really needed to complete my perfect little AA life was my perfect little AA boyfriend. And I had him all picked out. He was very handsome. And he sat across the room from me, and we flirted, and it was great, you know. Asked me out, we went on a date. And my sponsor's like, I told my sponsor. My sponsor's like, Sherry, I can't tell you what to do. As a sponsor, and I do this, I said, I can't tell you what to do. I'm here to work the 12 steps with you. But I can't, you know, I can't say no, 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 or blah, blah, blah. But I'm going to say this. This is not a good idea, and you should not really be doing this. This is just not a good idea. But I can't tell you that. Of course, I didn't listen. I did not listen, and I was in love, and he was in love, and we were in love, and we were Mr. and Mrs. AA for quite a few months, and then my dad got sick, really, really sick, hospitalized for about 3 weeks, and I was at that hospital. I was by his bed. I was there, and people were like, my sponsor included, Sherry, maybe you should come to a meeting. Maybe you should pick up a newcomer. Maybe you should. And I, you know what I said? I said, screw you. Screw you. Screw AA. This is my father. He's in the hospital. He's been there for me my entire life. AA can wait. And I didn't drink. But by the time the health crisis is scared, you know, my boyfriend and I were a little bit closer. And AA seemed a little less important. And it got on my nerves just a little bit more. And everybody started sharing that same dumb stuff again. The same person would say the same thing over and over and over again, you know, or they would talk about their bathroom tiles, and they would, you know, and I'd be like, what is this got to do with sobriety? And I got so, I remember gripping the steering wheel and singing the Serenity Prayer. grant me the serenity to accept that things I cannot change, other people, you know. And I drank. I did. I drank, didn't tell anybody. I was getting ready to pick up my year chip. I didn't tell anybody. I remember telling my home group members, like, they were planning my anniversary. Like, where are we going to go eat on your anniversary? And I remember bursting out in tears. I don't have an anniversary. I've been drinking for a week. And they were so kind and loving and understanding. And I picked up a white chip. And then I said, well, I don't care about a white chip. And I went on the biggest bender that you can imagine. Like 7 months. And I wasn't drinking for anything but to die. I was drinking to die. And not just drinking to die, there was like two serious suicide attempts. One I was hospitalized, and the other one, I just woke up in there because I just didn't, I couldn't see my life with alcohol, and I couldn't see my life without alcohol. And, you know, and this is where God intervened. This is where God did for me what I could not do for myself. And one more time, the justice system intervened. And I had done some things, not as bad as I've done in the past, but I had done some things where they found it necessary to have me off the street. And it saved my life. And as soon as I got into jail, you'd think I'd want to get sober. No, I wanted to take all y'all's medication because there was no more booze, but I was not ready to give it up. I was not ready to listen to God, to take clear direction, to reach out for help. I went into the nut ward of the jail and tried to buy everybody's nutty medication that makes me sleep. And I remember waking up out of that stupor, that nasty pill-induced stupor. And I said, they're going to let me out of here. They're going to let me out of this place. What am I going to do then? And that's nothing but God. That was not my idea. That was not anything but divine intervention. And I got on the phone. I called my sponsor, Collect. And my Collect call was accepted. And I started, and by a series of, you know, God-related events, things were put in my place where I could attend Alcoholics Anonymous, or I was put in a treatment center. Again, you know, I was allowed to come out to a sobriety house. But while I was there, you know, I still could not see. I could see where my life was powerless over alcohol, but I could not see where my life was unmanageable. I'll never forget calling my sponsor one night in jail. I was still in jail. Like, and my sponsor would say, like, what step do you think you're on? And I'd say, I don't know. I think I'm on step six. You know, I feel very humble today. I said, well, what about step one, Sherry? How are you? How is your life unmanageable today? And I said, well, I don't think it is. I got all my letters written. I got my canteen list made. I fit my budget in. Dead silence. My sponsor said, where are you? And I said, I am in jail. I mean, I was dead serious. I thought I was managing things well, you know? And ever since, you know, but when I came home, from that minute to this, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous and God have been at the center of my life. And the things that have transpired, my greatest fear was my dad was going to die while I was locked up and I wouldn't be able to go to the funeral. And that happened, you know, I wasn't able to go. And did I drink when I came home over it? No. That boyfriend stayed with me pretty much the whole time I was in there. Of course, he went out and got himself all twisted up and drunk and high and whatever. He died 2 weeks before I was like fully released from the treatment center. Yep. Stroke, drug and alcohol induced. You know, I've lost a lot of people to this, to alcoholism. And, you know, I don't question, like, why did I get to stay sober and someone else die? I used to do that a lot. It's just the way life has played out. And I can't can't, you know, and one of my favorite things that Sandy Beach says is, I can't explain to you why I have hope today. You know, I can tell you through my story. I can tell you that I've seen people get sober. I've seen people that were hopeless and helpless and turn around, you know. But you have to experience it. I had to experience it. I can't tell you why Alcoholics Anonymous work, you know, works for so many people for the last, what, 90 years. Why? I don't know. I have no answer for that. But it's one of the things that keeps me seeking in Alcoholics Anonymous is not for the answers, but for more of this experience, a spiritual experience. And I didn't understand what spirituality was. My sponsor today and my first sponsor was like, spirituality, Sherry, it's not lofty, high in the sky, pie in the sky, whatever. I was like, I'm never going to get the burning bush. Spirituality is practical to me. I'm able to be honest. I'm able to be trustworthy. You know, I show up for my commitments. I'm able to be dependable. Those are the spiritual principles. If I can continue to practice those spiritual principles in my life and pass them on, at least how I try to work that out in my life to other people, then I'm doing the best I can just for right now. Am I perfect? No. I talk spies you all the time. I am, you remember me talk about aimless? I am so spiritually lazy. You know, I have to be in like pain to make a change. If I am on coast mode and everything seems okay, why would I do anything different? Why would I seek to like enrich my experience? I'm doing okay. But my sponsor today, Meg, challenges me to enrich my experience. And that still need I have to, you know, fit in or please people puts me in the position where I will do that for her. So, you know, step seven, you know, our defects of character are removed in the order that God sees fit. Some of my character defects, you know, have not been removed because either they're still serving me or what I'm showing to other people is serving for them not to do what I'm doing. I don't know. Could work out that way. But the other thing I have, you know, I have a whole lot of gratitude. I have a huge amount of gratitude for my life today. I'm getting ready to move into a little house. I lived in the same place. I'm leaving. It'll be 12 years in October. I've never had that kind of stability. I have a job. I work, anybody familiar with ASAP? I work for the ASAP agency in Richmond. Somebody's giggling. Somebody knows about ASAP. Yep. And we serve 17 different jurisdictions that send people that have been convicted of drinking and driving. So I have the experience of seeing people come in from the very beginning, and they don't know I'm anonymous at work, except for just a couple people know I'm an AA. You know, I'm anonymous at work, but I get to be that. Hey, it's a whole lot in the beginning, but everything's gonna be okay. Just follow the directions, you know. And I get to smile and laugh and joke with these people that haven't had a whole lot to smile, laugh, and joke about. I let people unload on me with their scary attitudes sometimes, and it's okay today, you know, because that was me. I can see myself in them. I had some like health, crazy health issues with, I've had two eye surgeries since the beginning of the year, which was like out of nowhere. But it just, you know, I'm able to come through these things today. And I have a wealth of people in my life. You know, I said in the very beginning, I only ever wanted to fit in. I only started drinking really, you know, I wanted to have that effect. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to feel like I belonged somewhere. And alcohol did that for a while, and then it took it away because nobody wanted to be around me. But now it's been given back because I feel like this is where I belong, you know. This is, you're my people. And I say that, I know it's a little cliche, but I say that in the most sincere. And I am humble and grateful that you asked me to come and speak. And thank you so much for the opportunity.